Blog Talk Radio.
Baruch Hashem, this is Zion's Redemption Radio Network with your host Mark Lichtenwalter. Tonight we are going to be listening to the Levitical Priesthood Call on Purim, which is coming up in just a short time. We were going to do Kevin Kraut's call tonight, but something happened. I'm not exactly sure what, and they didn't do one, so I'm going to use this time to play the audio for the Levitical Council. It was about 2 weeks ago when they did this particular one, so I just got the audio to it yesterday, and so we're going to be putting it on the podcast. So they did a Levitical Council on Thursday, and I'll probably play the audio to that next Saturday. So, and then tomorrow, hopefully I can get on and do part two of chapter five of Kingdom of God, volume one, which we already started on Friday. So anyway, but this is about Purim, and David Fairman is talking, and Jonathan Felt, but for the most part, it'll be Joshua Erickson. Anybody who is interested in celebrating the Hebrew festival, feasts and festivals with us can contact me. Just contact me on Messenger through facebook.com/LAZURUS1977, or you can contact me by emailing me at godismycompass@gmail.com. That's godismycompass@gmail.com. I usually check those every couple of days. So if I haven't got back to you after a couple of days, then email me again or go through Messenger to try to get a hold of me. I try to check out the message requests and all of that daily. So, all right. So anyway, this will be 1 hour and 46 minutes. And I hope you enjoy it. I enjoyed the program. I contributed as well, but Joshua Erickson really, really did a good job presenting the information. So we'll turn it right over to him. This is a pre-recorded audio from the Levitical Council, and I think it was 2 weeks ago that we did this. So enjoy. Thank you for listening.
I know God has a hand in it. I know that when it's time for me to go to where the next gig is, so to speak, it'll be where He wants me to be, and the time just isn't right yet. Okay. You think it'll be right around there in Ohio?
I don't know. I feel drawn to Missouri, but I don't feel...
Let's read verse 22, Esther 9:22. So this is after their victory, and we all probably know the story pretty well, I think. So we probably won't go over the whole thing, but
tablet
continues.
As the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them, from sorrow to joy, and from mourning unto good day, that they should make in days of feasting and joys, and of sending portions one to another, and gifts to the poor.
Right. So yeah, this month, this day, this month was turned from sorrow to joy, and from mourning to a good day. So things were flipped upside down. The thing that everyone expected, or many people expected to happen, didn't happen. And, of course, why was that? It's because in verse 1 of chapter 9, do you want to read that as well, Eugene?
Sure. Let me up. Just a moment. Now, in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, that on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them.
Yeah, it was turned to the contrary. Everything flipped upside down. In Hebrew, and I don't speak Hebrew, but I just know a few words. So, but in Hebrew, the phrase for things being flipped upside down is v'naha foku. V'naha foku, and that's what it says there in verse 1 and also in verse 22, when it says things turn to the contrary. It's v'naha foku. So, of course, things were looking. There's several actually turns of events here, right? The first one really begins with Vashti, who's the queen, and she's sitting high on her royal horse, and suddenly everything turns upside down, just in a moment. It's unexpected, maybe. And she is made low. And in her place, we have Esther, who is made low, right? She's a Jew. Says specifically she's from the tribe of Benjamin, which becomes important to the story. We'll talk about that in a minute. But, she's part of this this conquered people, lowly in the kingdom, and yet she is then exalted and becomes queen. So there's a turnaround right there. And then we have, of course, the evil Haman. And whenever the Jews say Haman, then everyone boo. Yes.
Boo.
Yes. Thank you. Because we want to fulfill the commandment, which says to blot out the name of Amalek. So we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. But so, of course, the evil plans, which are to destroy the Jews, they actually come to naught, as Eugene read. Okay, everything turned to the contrary, and the Jews had rule over them that hated them. So some really kind of amazing turn of events that happened. And not only for the entire Jewish people and for Esther, but also for Mordecai, who is Esther's cousin or uncle and close relation, been like a father to her. But he also switches places with the evil Haman. Thank you.
Yes,
hisses are welcomed as well. They trade places as well. And so this is another important part of the story, is to remember that, and this is a theme not only in the book of Esther, but it's very prominent in the book of Esther, but it's throughout the scriptures as well. You can all probably think of a verse or three that talk about the first being last, and the last first, and the valleys being exalted, and the mountains made low, and the rough places made smooth, and the smooth places broken up, and there's the story of Lazarus the rich man and Lazarus, and it says they trade places, Jesus tells in his parable. It's a theme also throughout the scriptures that someday all of the injustice will be righted, and all the every misplaced bit of power that the evil one has used to dominate people of God will eventually be flipped upside down. And though we are subject to death and hell, at some point we will put all the enemies under our feet, and everything will be righted in that day. And so so the story of Esther kind of illustrates this idea as well. And one of the most amazing rectifications, I should say, or one of the most amazing setting things right and flipping things back to, you know, putting kind of God's people back on top where they're supposed to be is prominent in the story of Esther, and that is the redemption of Saul, the redemption of King Saul. And the story of Esther has a lot to do with the redemption of King Saul. So let's talk, though, first about the fall. So who can tell me when that happened or what was involved?
I know Eugene can.
Yeah. There were two instances. I'm remembering the second one, but the first one was just a year into his reign, and he was going to go to battle against Philistines, and that Samuel says, "I'm going to be there in 7 days. Wait, and we will make sacrifice." And the people were scared because there was over 100,000, 150,000 Philistines, and they were a couple valleys over. And some of them started to cower and to run away. But there were those that waited because they had faith in Samuel. And then the 7 days showed up, and Samuel didn't at their accomplishment. So then people started running away and hiding. And they were armed without swords or they just had farm tools, mattocks, rakes, stuff like that. And the only one that had real armor was Saul. So they didn't have confidence against armed men. Saul took it upon himself to make the sacrifice before God.
Right.
And that was not his place. And when Saul came, he says, "What have you done? You were not supposed to do this. You were supposed to have faith and wait upon the Lord. Because of this, the kingdom will be ripped from you and given to another that will obey God."
Yeah. Pretty harsh. Yes, that's good. And then, and I'm glad you brought that up because I wasn't going to mention that one, but I think that actually plays into the story in a nice way as well. The second one, which is not much later, just a few chapters later, Saul is commanded to destroy the Amalekites.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is in 1 Samuel 15.
Right.
Now, but first we need to talk about who the Amalekites are, and they were the very first people to attack the Israelites when they had come out of bondage in Egypt, and they were going through the wilderness, and the Amalekites came and attacked them, and attacked them in a very dishonorable way too. They kind of came up in the rear and started killing off the weak and those who were kind of straggling behind, and kind of just to be mean. But of course, this is the famous battle where Moses raises his arms, and Aaron and Hur are on either side, and Joshua is fighting against the Amalekites, and they eventually defeat the Amalekites, and God gives them commandment relating to that. And let me see. I'm going to go to that. Let's see. I think it's in Deuteronomy 25. Let me see if that's the one I'm thinking of. Oh, no. Oh, let's see. Let's see. Story of Amalek. I'll have to find that later. The story of Amalek's in Exodus 17, I believe. Let me find it. Sorry. Yes. So Exodus 17, verse 8 is kind of where it where the story begins. It's just as I had talked about. But let's see if I can find the other
keyword H-U-R, her.
There we go. Oh, it is Deuteronomy 25. Okay.
Oh, okay.
So Deuteronomy 25, I'll read this. They were given a commandment this is Deuteronomy 25, 17 through 19. The Lord said, remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when Jehovah thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which Jehovah thy God giveth thee, for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. So this is a pretty strong command, and also, I mean, it's kind of a strange command. I mean, usually we think of God says to forgive and he forgets, I remember them no more and all that. But in this case, and there's a lot that we could go into about that, I'm sure. But in this case, he says, I want you to remember what Amalek did forever and blot out the remembrance, blot out the name of Amalek. And so, so back to Saul. Let me just go back even further. So we're talking about what happened at Saul, but this kind of enmity between Amalek and Israel goes back quite a bit further. So it goes back to the Exodus, which was, of course, before the time of the kings. It actually goes back in the time of the judges as well. There's a story of Ehud, and it's interesting that it mentions that he's a Benjamite as well. And all the Benjamites in the scripture are that are mentioned are left-handed. So Ehud is left-handed, and he's one of the judges. And Israel is being attacked and is under the subjection of the Canaanites, including the Amalekites, and their king Eglon. Ehud goes to have a secret meeting with Eglon. They check his side for weapons, but he shows them his left side. Which is where people usually keep their sword because most people are right-handed, but he doesn't uncover, he's wearing a cloak and he doesn't uncover his right side, which is where his dagger is, and they let him in to see the king, and the king locks the doors, and Ehud assassinates the king and frees Israel for a little bit. So that's during the time of the judges. We go back to the Exodus where Amalek attacked, but we go back even beyond that, and the original Amalek, who the Amalekites are named after, is the grandson of Esau. So Of course, we know Esau and Jacob had troubles from the beginning. So this goes back a long ways. So in 1 Samuel 15, this is where the Lord tells Saul, I've got a job for you. I want you to. In verse 2, the Lord says, I remember what Amalek did to Israel. It says, now go and smite Amalek. And he commands them to utterly destroy everything pertaining to Amalek. Spare them not, both man, woman, infant, suckling, oxen, sheep, camel, and ass. So, now, and Saul says, I'll do it. And of course, we know what happens. Saul doesn't do it, right? And Samuel comes and is very disappointed with Saul again. And Samuel asks Saul, why have you not kept the commandment? And Saul says, I have. I've kept the commandment exactly as it was given. And Samuel asked him then, what are all those cows and sheep that I can hear? And who remembers what Saul's reply is? Why did they eat the spoil?
Well, he said the people wanted me at first, and then he said, kind of waffled there.
Yeah, that's right. He says, yes, well, we saved the best stuff so that we can sacrifice it to the Lord. And Samuel responds with the famous line, obedience is better than sacrifice.
What I find interesting is verse 20. Samuel saying, but I did obey the Lord when he flatly didn't.
Yeah. And he also says, look, I'm here. I've captured the king alive. And no, that is not... and who knows? Well, actually, we do know. We do know that besides their king, Agag, that there must have been other Amalekites that survived and escaped as well. And they probably escaped because Saul didn't do the job, right? They went and attacked, and they got distracted, and they turned from their objective and veered to, gather up the herds before the herds escape, and in doing that, they let the people escape.
Well, it was not just an Amalekite; it was part of the royal family, because in Esther we find their Agagite.
That's right. Yes, very good. So, so Saul just fails in so many ways. He's supposed to destroy the Amalekites, supposed to destroy Agag. He doesn't. He's not supposed to take the spoils. He does. He's not supposed to offer sacrifices. Even earlier, he does. And the Lord says, I just reject you even more. Like, I've rejected you from being king. And, of course, he was king the rest of his life, though, but David comes up next. And so not only was he rejected from being king, but of course his descendants were rejected from being king. So this is a harsh blow for Saul, but that was what the Lord had decreed. So, all right, but if we go back to Esther then, we learn a couple of things, right? So, first of all, this is interesting. I'll give a little background, I guess, just so you've read it. So there's King Artaxerxes or Ahasuerus. He's the king of Persia. He's recently become king. He's decided to have a new capital city, which is in Shushan. And in order to celebrate, he has this giant party that lasts for 6 months, and everyone's invited. And and there's some interesting Jewish traditions about that. We'll get into that probably. He requests the queen to come, and Queen Vashti, and she refuses. And according to Jewish legend, she is the granddaughter of King Nebuchadnezzar. And so she says, you know, I'm not the king's servant, I'm the queen. But the king disagrees, of course, and one of his ministers suggests that he dispose of her and find a new queen. So now, let's see. That's basically chapter one. Chapter two is where Esther goes. She's chosen. But it's interesting that we're introduced to kind of the heroes of the story, which is Mordecai and
Yay! Yes,
that's right. In verse, it's very interesting. In verse 5, Esther chapter 2, verse 5. who's got that? Who's got their book of Esther open?
I have it.
Okay. Verse 5 of chapter 2.
Now in Shushan, to the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, and the son of Shar, the son of Shimeel. Of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite.
Yeah, really cool. It says there specifically that he is a Benjamite, a descendant of son of Yair, descendant of Shimei, okay, and descendant of Kish, and it's. It's interesting if we go to I'll just read it here, but in 2 Samuel chapter 16. Samuel 16, is this where I want to be? 5. Oh no, that's not quite what I wanted. That one's good. Let's see. Okay, let me go back to 1 Samuel, actually. Let's see. Actually, I'm going to do a little search here. Let's see. Okay, we'll go to 1 Samuel 10, actually. There might be in other places too, but...
he's first mentioned in Samuel 9:1.
Okay, great. Go ahead and read it.
Oh, okay. We get back to... Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechoreth, the son of Apeha, a Benjaminite, a man, a mighty man of power.
Good. And he had a son whose name was Saul. So, so Kish was Saul's father. And then in Esther, we see Mordecai, who is a descendant of Kish, a Benjamite, and it specifically mentions this in some of the Targums. It actually gives more of Mordecai's genealogy, and and says you know, it ascribes direct descendancy to Mordecai, that he and Esther are actually direct descendants of King Saul. So in either case, even if it doesn't have all of it, there's a clue there. It says Mordecai is a Benjamite, a descendant of Kish, and he's here to do a job that has been left undone for generations. So in chapter 2, Mordecai, who sits in the king's gates, he's the, you know, he's a servant of the king, gatekeeper, and he overhears a plot to assassinate the king, and of course he goes and he wonders what to do, because when there's a plot to kill the king, there's a dilemma for anyone who wants to stop it, because you don't know who you can talk to, right? Because you don't know who's in on the plot, and you don't want to reveal yourself to the enemies of the king. So, but he knows what to do. He tells his cousin, or
Hadassah.
Who's Esther? Yeah, and he can trust her. And then she, of course, has access to the king. And so they capture the chamberlains who are plotting. They're put to death. And it's noted in the Chronicles of the Kings of Persia. In chapter 3, we are introduced to the villain, although Jewish tradition says that he is mentioned in chapter 1 as Memucan, and that he is the king's advisor that advised him to dispose of Vashti, and the king listens to him. And so this actually, if this Jewish tradition is correct, and I don't have any reason to disbelieve it, but if it's correct, then it puts Esther in a very precarious place, that even as queen, that Haman may have more power than her, and could, if he, you know, at his suggestion, have the king dispose of her as well. So, but right there in verse 1 of chapter 3, it says that there's... that Achashverosh promotes Haman, the son of Hammedatha. It says he is an Agagite. So he's a descendant of Agag, the king that Saul was supposed to have killed but didn't. And he's promoted and becomes basically the king's second in command. Similar to the way Joseph was kind of second in command to Pharaoh in Egypt. And so he was, he gets the robe, and he gets, eventually he gets the king's ring, and everyone bows down to Haman when he walks by. And, except for Mordecai, and probably not Esther either, because she, even though Haman maybe has more sway with the king, she does outrank him. As far as her royal position. So basically it's Esther and Mordecai probably, although we don't know about Esther, but probably those are the only two that don't bow down to Haman. And in verse 3 of chapter 3, the other servants, so Mordecai's fellow servants, they ask him why he transgresses the king's commandments. Why he doesn't bow down. And he says in verse 4, he says, "I am a Jew. That's the reason why I won't bow down, because I am a Jew." Now, here's an interesting question then. Like, is is there something wrong with bowing down? Is there something wrong with Mordecai bowing to Ahasuerus, the king? What do you think?
I would say yes. Back then, a lot of kings liked to liken themselves to God. And
yeah.
Kings were not supposed to worship anybody but God. They were not to bow down to men. They were not to bow down to idols. They're not to bow down to anything, any likeness of anything on the earth. I mean, that's in the Torah. And so
yes.
Here he was, being obedient, and Haman wanted that worship.
Yes. Very good. So, so that is correct, and I like what you said about the kings, because that is so true. Very, very often, the king was considered deity. So that's an interesting point. So that would certainly be frowned upon. But actually, just bowing in general is not forbidden. And there are a few times when this happens. I'll just read a couple here. One is Genesis 23, let's see, verse 7. Okay. Abraham stood up and bowed himself to the people of the land, even to the children of Heth. And he communed with them, saying, If it be your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat me to Ephron, the son of Zohar. So this is when he purchases the cave to be his burying place. But he bows himself down to the people of Heth. We have in the story of Joseph in Egypt, when Joseph's brothers come, they all bow down to him. Of course, this is according to the dream that he had about the sheaves bowing down to, you know, his sheep and the sun, the moon, and stars, you know, giving obeisance to. And they do. They bow down, and there's nothing wrong with that. But Eugene is exactly right that there is a certain kind of bowing that is absolutely forbidden in the Torah. And it's not necessarily bowing down to, you know, to men as a sign of respect. But it is if it's related to idols.
Well, you hit upon it as a sign of respect. In the East, I mean, all over the East, from Middle East to Japan, bowing is a form of greeting. All right. And so if you bow as a greeting, as courtesy, there's nothing wrong with that. But to bow in obeisance, there is something wrong with that.
Yes, exactly. So Exodus 20, right, this is the 10 sections, the 10 commandments. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, Yahovah thy God, am a jealous God. So there are a few other places where bowing down in a worshipful way to any other gods besides Yahovah, that is expressly forbidden. So now, this wasn't to the king, though. This was to Haman, who was not the king. The story doesn't say that he claimed to be a deity. So how do we deal with this? There's at least a couple of ways. One Jewish tradition is that Haman had on his shoulder, on like his cloak or whatever, embroidered or like a pin, like a piece of jewelry that was an emblem of one of his false gods. And he would wear this around, and everyone would bow down to him, and he would just chuckle to himself because everyone was also bowing down to his god. And so, this may be an explanation. And another one may simply be that Mordecai felt that it is not in keeping, that specifically since Haman was a descendant of Agag, and he was commanded to blot out the remembrance of Agag and to, certainly not to reverence him, but rather to to remember that Agag is the Lord's enemy. So that could be a reason too, and maybe both those reasons, and maybe more. I don't know, but it is interesting that the only thing he says is I am a Jew. So we kind of have to look a little deeper to find out why that was specifically forbidden. So there's at least several reasons. So this, of course, whatever the reasons are, though, this doesn't make Haman happy at all. And in fact, Haman is fuming about this and decides to really, he just decides to follow his ancestors' footsteps and decides that he is also going to destroy Israel, not just Mordecai, but all the Jews that he can possibly destroy. And so he sits down and casts, that is, lots in chapter 3. And this was in the first month of Nisan. Of course, this is the month of Abib. So he sits down and casts lots, and he goes from month to month and from day to day until he finally settles upon the 12th month, which is Adar. And he decides that on the 13th day of the 12th month, that's the day he's going to kill all the Jews. But even though Haman is second in command, he doesn't have the authority to carry out his decision without the king's approval. So he goes to the king and he tells the king some lies and says that there's these awful people in your land who don't keep their law, our laws, and they're very troublesome, and they don't speak our language, and they don't. They are diverse from all people, but he is very, Haman's very generous, and he says, O king, I will destroy these people from your kingdom. And he says, I will even pay the soldiers' wages to carry this out. From my own treasury, which is probably things that he's, his ill-gotten gain. And the king, he doesn't even mention the name of the people. He just says, there is a people dispersed among your kingdom. Doesn't even mention them. And the king, doesn't really pay. Maybe he's thinking of other things. Maybe the king's lazy. I don't know. But he gives Haman his ring and says, make it so. So he writes these letters and they get sent out on the 13th day of the 12th month, then everyone in the kingdom is supposed to attack the Jews, and it says, and to take the spoil of them for prey. So says, go ahead and kill your Jewish neighbors, and all of their property will then be yours, and you can carry this out with the official sanction of the king. Awful stuff. Amazing. Of course, this is a horrible thing all the Jews in the kingdom. They hear about this, and everyone's quite worried. This is going to happen at the end of the year. We remember the first month, and so in the 11 or 12 months from that, the time that the letters went out, about 11 months, I guess, probably, then everyone was going to be slaughtered. All in one day, said the letter said, all in one day. And then it said, and this is another kind of interesting thing about the story of Esther, is that there's lots and lots of alcohol involved. It starts out with this big drinking party, and Vashti's got her own drinking party, and then there's a drinking party in Shushan, and then after Haman and the king make this deal to destroy all the Jews, and it says they sat down to drink. So there's a lot of drunkenness. That's maybe part of the story too, is the it's kind of a commentary on the way that we humans go about our lives, kind of just not really realizing what's going on and what God is doing, but we just go about our own lives in our drunken stupor, oblivious, kind of, I guess you could say, to what God is performing all around us. So anyway, so they sit down, Haman and the king sit down to have a drink after the dirty deed is done. So Mordecai, though, he tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth, ashes on his head, and mourns, and all the Jews are mourning. And Queen Esther is worried about this, right? She sends a message. She gets a message back, and Mordecai tells her about the evil plan and tells her that she must go in and intercede on the behalf of her people. And she's nervous about this, of course, and rightly so. She should be nervous about this because she knows, like everyone in the kingdom knows, what just happened to the last queen when she displeased the king, went against what the king had commanded, right? The story of Esther actually it's hidden what happened to Vashti. So some stories say she was just kind of demoted and just back into the king's harem, but not the queen anymore. Some traditions say she was exiled, and some say she was executed. So, but no matter what, she was dishonored, disgraced, and maybe even killed. And so, the fear of death is very real and present thing. But Mordecai tells her,
well, if I might,
please.
The one thing that's in the story that most people do not, it doesn't click when they read it, is she, Esther, Hadassah, was brought, and she did not see the king for close to a year. And the king was entertained every night, and there were two houses, one for virgins and one for the women that the king had already seen. And there were like 200 and something before her. And when Mordecai, I was getting a tiny bit ahead, asked her, she said, the king has not called for me in over a month. So the thing is it wasn't just a couple of girls. I mean, the king had a stable of hundreds, literally hundreds of women to choose from. And so that made her being called up, and her place was more precarious because the king had a huge harem. And that's the point that a lot of people don't understand. And so it was a very real, she had power, but it's like you mentioned earlier, Agag. She was hidden away in the harem, and so she would not have seen him unless he was invited in or she was brought out.
Yeah.
So that there's a lot. Her place was more precarious than most people think.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt, but
I thought that
was pertinent.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think, why is she nervous? Like, she's the queen. But she had every reason to be nervous. So, of course, Mordecai, in response, tells her, well, the Jews are going to be saved one way or another. But if you don't step up, you and your house are going to be destroyed anyway. And salvation will come from somewhere else. So she says, okay, everyone, I will fast for 3 days and everyone else fast too. And then I'll go into the king, and if I die, I die. Now I want to, at this point, I want to back up a little. I want to mention a little bit about Esther because I, now, Hadassah is the myrtle tree. But her Persian name, Esther, means star. So, Esther or Aster, is the root of words like astronomy and asteroid and so it means a star. And I believe that Esther is mentioned in prophecy in Numbers 24. So Numbers 24 is when Balaam is hired by the king of the Moabites to come and curse Israel, and the king of the Moabites is horribly displeased with Balaam's work because he keeps blessing Israel when he's supposed to curse them. But anyway, Balaam gives this prophecy in Numbers 24. Let's see. I'm going to read verse 7. It's interesting.
That one is.
He says, "He shall pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted." Okay, and he says God brought them forth out of Egypt and talks about lions and unicorns. And then I'm going to go to verse 17, and this is a very interesting too. It says, and this is commonly seen as a prophecy about Messiah. But I think it's very clear that Esther is a type of Messiah, just as many of the other prophets and prominent people in the Old Testament stories were types of Messiah in one way or another. So, says, "I shall," this is verse 17 of Numbers 24, "I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter." So that's royalty, "and a scepter shall rise out of Israel and shall smite the corners of Moab and destroy all the children of Sheth." And it goes on, talks about Edom, which is Esau, who is Amalek's grandfather. Okay, Edom will be a possession. Seir, this is the land of Esau, will be a possession. And Israel will do valiantly. Out of Jacob will come. And then in verse 20, when he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, "Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he perish forever." And so here he is. He sees a royal star coming out of Jacob, and this royal star is going to destroy Amalek forever. And so I think that this I think Esther fulfills this prophecy, at least a partial fulfillment, in a beautiful way. So, let's go back to So let's see. So okay, we're on to chapter 5 now. So Esther, she goes in, and she puts on her royal. Oh, this is, I remember thing. This is very interesting too. The symbolism is there, and this is just more of the Esther being a type of Messiah. Of course, the high priest is a type of Messiah as well. And there's one day, one special day of the year when the high priest would go in to the king's chamber and stand before the king's throne. This is speaking of in the Holy of Holies, the mercy seat, right? He would go in, and there was a real danger. If his heart was not pure, or his intentions were not pure, what would happen if he went into the chamber? He would die, right? The high priest was in danger of dying, going into the Holy of Holies. And what was he going into the Holy of Holies for? Is to plead for the salvation of Israel. So here is Esther going in to before the king on a certain day to plead for the entire nation, and if she fails, death is the consequence. So there she is, high priestess, I guess, and she comes in, and the king is surprised, but his heart is softened, and he lowers his scepter, and she touches it, and he says, "What do you want? Anything for you, queen, even half my kingdom, it's yours." And she says, "I just want you to come to a party. You and Haman, I want you to come to a party at my place later." So the king and Haman is thrilled. Haman is so thrilled. He's just beside himself. They go to the banquet, and the king says, "All right, this is a lovely party. They have a good time." He says, "Now tell me what you want." She says, "I just want you to come to another party tomorrow, you and Haman." And Haman is just floating on cloud nine now. He's invited to the private parties of the king and the queen. And he's going home to tell his wife, Zeresh, about how amazing. Actually, I think he says... let's see. We'll get there maybe.
What, verse 8 or 9?
No, I thought that he said at some point that his star is on the rise.
Oh.
But I'll have to find that. And maybe I might be remembering wrong. Anyway, so the queen says, "Come to another party tomorrow." And Haman's going home to tell his wife, and while he's on his way home, he passes by Mordecai. And Mordecai, again, fails to bow to him. And let's see. So, let's see. So they said, here we go. In Esther 5, verse 13, Haman is telling his wife about how, he's just how promoted he is. He's lifted, not only has the king lifted him up, but he has also lifted himself up in his enormous ego, his enormous pride. But he says in verse 13, all of this is nothing as long as Mordecai doesn't bow to me. Like, he would trade the entire empire of Persia bowing to him if he could just get Mordecai to bow down. He would just Mordecai bow for the bow of the rest of the world. So, I mean, it's an extreme, but this is the fever that he'd worked himself up to. So Zeresh suggests, well, just go ahead and we'll just kill him. Ask the king. The king will give you permission. The king does everything. You're like you're in the king's favor. The king will do anything you tell him, anything you ask him. And so Mordecai thinks, Haman thinks that's a great idea. He makes a gallows 50 cubits high in his own backyard. And he's gonna hang Mordecai on in the morning. And
how tall is 50 cubits?
Oh, well, cubits 19 and a half inches times 50. That's huge.
Yeah.
100. Yeah.
Quite a hole. So, getting close. Yeah, it's probably 80 feet high or something like that.
Imagine all the effort to build that thing.
Well, yes and no. A gallows. Back then, what they hung people on was not a gallows that we have, where we use rope.
Yeah.
That was a sharpened stake.
It was a big
and you would, yeah, and you would put somebody, and it would go through their rear end and come out through the top of their head. And they would hang there on that spike.
Oh, yeah, but how do you get an 80-foot spike? That's a lot.
Yeah.
Well, you can put in a big tree.
A big tree and start whittling.
Yeah,
whittling one end thin. Yeah, one end sharp. It is comical. I mean, it turns out. I mean, it's. It is comical. Chapter 6 is the most is the funniest chapter in all of Scripture. I think. I mean,
Wiley Coyote of the Roadrunner here.
Yeah, it is the funniest by far. The funniest chapter. So, Haman's very excited about this plan, so excited that he can't even wait until morning to go and ask the king's permission. So he has the gallows built, and then he rushes off to interrupt the king's sleep to ask him if he could please get his hands on Mordecai and, you know, fix all of his problems. So, meanwhile, the king can't sleep anyway, and this is where the chances come into play because, you know, this is the lot is cast in the lap, but the whole outcome is of the Lord. So there's all these chances. Unlikely events that line up and stack up in this miraculous way. So Haman's preparing his plan that very minute, and by chance, the king this night can't sleep. And he decides to do what will put anyone to sleep is by reading Chronicles. So he says, bring me the Chronicles, and by chance, the book falls open to the story of Mordecai, the Jew, saving his life. And, you know, he asks his servant, what was done to honor Mordecai for saving my life? And he scans the page, and it says nothing was done. And the king is utterly shocked at this. And just as the king is pondering this and is in shock about this, then by chance, Haman comes and knocks on, you know, his chamber door, and he's ushered in, and the king says, Haman, you know, just the man I wanted to see. Of course, the king is thinking, I need some advice. Haman is thinking, the king is happy to see me because I'm so great, of course. And before Haman gets to ask his question, the king says, what shall I do for the man the king delights to honor? And, I mean, Haman's imagination just starts going wild because he knows that the king is talking about him, but the king just hasn't said it yet. And so he thinks up the grandest, most ego-inflating reward that he can think of at the moment. And he says, bring out the king's royal robe and put it on. on that man. Bring out the king's crown and put it on that man. Bring out the king's horse and put that man on the king's horse. And then have one of the royal, you know, the most royal prince, the most noble prince in the kingdom, lead this horse through the town of Shushan, proclaiming to everyone, this is what the king does for the man that he delights to honor. And Ahasuerus says, excellent idea, Haman. He says, you are the man. He says, I want you to take the robe and you to take the crown and take the horse and give those to Mordecai and do everything that you just suggested to Mordecai. Minaha Foku! So, Haman was crushed, but he was obedient. And so, embarrassing, I'm sure, just humiliating, and he was just fuming. So he does that in the morning, goes and finds Mordecai, and honors him in this way. And here is the first inkling that we have of things being set right with Saul. So Saul being redeemed. Here we have Saul's descendant of Kish, a Benjamite, Mordecai. And Saul lost the kingship. And here Mordecai is being elevated. He's wearing the king's crown and wearing the king's robe and riding the king's horse. And so, I mean, he is the king, in symbolically anyway, right? He's elevated to this position that his ancestor had lost. So Haman is humiliated, but he doesn't have too much time to sulk because he's got an appointment with the king and the queen. So he doesn't get to ask the king to if he could kill Mordecai, but he runs off to the banquet, and there at the banquet they have a great time. Haman probably does not have a great time, so he can't stop thinking about what happened in the morning. But then the king asks Esther, "What do you want? Half the kingdom is yours." And she says, "I don't want half the kingdom. I just want my life and the life of my people." And the king is shocked, and right, he asks, "What are you talking about?" She says, "We've been, we've been sold for bondmen and for bondwomen." So this is definitely kind of bringing back the story of Egypt and redemption. So he says, "What are you talking about?" The king is just confused, of course. And finally, she points out who the evil orchestrator is. It is the wicked Haman. And Haman was just as surprised as the king, I'm sure. He had no idea what she was about to say. And it says that he was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king is so upset by what he's just heard, by this startling revelation, that he needs to compose himself. And so he rushes out of the room in a flurry so that he can kind of gather his thoughts. And Haman kind of watches him leave the room and then realizes that he's probably in a very bad position. And he reaches out to the queen, grabs her, and is pleading for his life. But he's, the queen's lying on her couch, on her bed there. They're eating while they're reclining, as royalty likes to do, as free men like to do. And so he's there kneeling right there on her bedstead, grabbing the queen, begging for his life. And then right at that moment, the king comes back in and says, "You dare to attack the queen in my palace? What are you doing? And, you know, he says guards seize him. They immediately grab Haman. And he just is probably just speechless. I mean, what can he say when the king asks him, will you attack my queen too? And then one of the king's guards comes up and, you know, is looking for a promotion. And he finds the right moment and says, you see, look out the window there. Do you see that gallows 50 cubits high in Haman's backyard? That is where Haman was going to kill Mordecai. And you know, the king looks at Haman. Mordecai, the man who saved my life, the man that I just honored. And Haman, you know, says nothing again, because what can he say? And the king says, take Haman and hang him on the gallows that he built for Mordecai. And then he takes the ring from Haman and puts it on Mordecai's finger. Mordecai wasn't there, but later, right? He takes the ring and he gives Mordecai the position. And so they switch places, right? Vinaha Fotu. Haman is hung on the gallows that was intended for Mordecai, and Mordecai gets Haman's position as second in command to the king. So now, of course, the law is that whatever the king has decreed and has been sealed by the ring is immutable. So the king, sometimes in children's books, I'm kind of bothered by it. So a lot of times in children's books, it says, or stories, it says that the king undid the, you know, reversed the decree or something, and it's not exactly that. Because the king said, I can't reverse it, but why don't you go ahead now, Mordecai, and write a new letter and sign it with my signet and, you know, write whatever you can think of to try to make things better. Well, they can't undo it, but what they say is, yes, it is true that there was royal sanction given to attack the Jews on this day. But now, royal sanction is given to the Jews to defend themselves. And in chapter 8, so the king took off the ring, gave it to Mordecai. Let's see. They wrote all the letters. They sealed the letters, sent them out. And let's see, okay. And then it says, this is at the end of chapter 8. It says, Mordecai went out from the presence of the king, and he was dressed in royal apparel, blue and white, and with a crown of gold on his head, garment of fine linen, and purple. So it's definitely hinting at, showing Mordecai as priest and king, okay, and everyone had a glad day, the Jews especially. But it was interesting because it says at the very end, the last sentence says, many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. You see, when previously, when the decree had gone out, it was just everyone is free to despise the Jews. The king doesn't care about them. The kingdom doesn't care about them. Take their property. Take their lives. It means nothing to us. But now the Jews are exalted in the kingdom. Mordecai is exalted. The queen, everyone knows now that the queen is a Jew as well, and the second in command. Like, the Jews are on the top now. And so go ahead and kill all the Jews, your neighbors, and take their property. That's great when it's officially sanctioned, but now the sanction of the kingdom is behind the Jews instead of behind their enemies. And so so things begin to flip around there as well, not only for Mordecai and Haman, but for people throughout the whole kingdom. And then, of course, in the last chapter, the day comes, and the Jews go out and they have a glorious victory. And on the 13th, they They have a victory. They defeat all of their enemies. Haman's 10 sons, okay, are taken. They are hanged as well. And so kind of Agag and his descendants are, at least as far as we know, Agag and his descendants are finally destroyed. It says that on the 14th day, so the day after, that all the Jews outside of Shushan, they all have a celebration and a day of rest and gladness, and they celebrate their victory. On the 14th, inside the capital city, though, where Haman probably had many followers, the Jews inside the city, they have another day of fighting, and then they rest and celebrate their victory on the 15th. So those 2 days, the 14th and the 15th, are the days of celebration. And this is the last thing that I want to say. It's interesting. So in chapter 9, so this is kind of the completion of the redemption of Saul. Chapter 9, verse 10. Okay. It says, the 10 sons of Haman, the sons of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they. But on the spoil they laid not their hand. And this is a reversal as well, because you remember the original plan, we've mentioned it, was for the Persians to take the spoil of the Jews. But now that the Jews were on top, it says they did not even touch the spoil. And this is what Saul had been commanded to do, not to touch the spoil. And here his descendants are finally fulfilling the command that was given to Saul many centuries earlier. So, and then it's repeated, let's see, 15 and 16. So the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day also of the month Adar and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey they laid not their hand. But the Jews that were in the king's provinces, they gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000, but they laid not their hands on the prey. So they left the spoil. So there we have it. The descendants of Saul fulfilling and redeeming the Benjamite line in a way, in a beautiful way. And God showing his favor still for the descendants of Saul and for his people, the Jews. And I think this is a beautiful story on many levels. I've mentioned already, but not the least of which is that it gives me, and I get a little emotional when I think about this, but it gives me some personal hope that even if there are commands that God gives me that I fail at, that he is still, the destinies of nations are still in his hand. And even if I fail someday, my children may redeem me. So that's a beautiful thing to me too. So.
Well, and where are we now with redeeming Zion in that same way?
Yeah, good question.
Well, we are that generation that is making up for our fathers that have defaulted on the Lord.
Yeah.
We're establishing Zion and bringing back Torah that has been abandoned. So, our heritages, we are doing that, even with our faults.
Good. All right,
one more part, it goes back to Numbers 24. It's interesting that the blessing was that he shall pour out the blessings from many waters. So the king will be higher than the kingdom of Agag. But what's interesting, and his kingdom shall be exalted. So the Lord knew Agag was a powerful kingdom under his ruler. Solomon was the greatest kingdom because riches poured from all over the world in Israel. But the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, which later came down to the kingdom that Esther was in, was the biggest. It says from Ethiopia and Africa all the way to India. That was a huge area of land to be controlled, and all the wealth of that. So his wealth was phenomenal. Now, what's interesting, the king they're talking about is Christ, or Yeshua. And a lot of people don't realize this, but Daniel, being a eunuch in that kingdom, was wealthy, just like Agag was, as a counselor. But he had no inheritance. And he put aside all his wealth in the money changers, the Jewish money changers, the wise men, and his charge to them is, when you see this constellation in the sky in the future, take my treasure, all of it, except for the what you know, for maintenance until that time, to give to the child that is born that star portrays. The wise men that came in from the east were the Hebrews that had been down through the centuries guarding, multiplying, and increasing that treasure. And so when Yeshua was given to at 2 years of age, that treasure of frankincense, myrrh, and the gold, it was a whole caravan that he was given. And so he was wealthier than all, and he exalted the kingdom in the end. So it's the thing that a lot of people, unless you do some really heavy digging, would never know. And there it was way back in Moses' day. This was all foreseen years and centuries before it happened. Praise the Lord.
Yeah. Amen.
The Japanese have their emperor goes into the Holy of Holies one time at the beginning of his reign alone to plead for his nation and to meet God, which is another fascinating parallel to these kings and Israel and the remnant that still exists to this day.
Yeah, interesting.
Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you. That was great.
Thank you.
And I think it'll get recorded. It's been recording, so I'll go ahead and post that up, and people can listen to it. Mark on the road, Brett, anybody else. So I think we're blessed with good teachers, this tiny little group of ours. And thank you, Joshua.
Yeah.
We'll hear again from Eugene soon. So, all right. So no Thursday night meeting. We'll go ahead and postpone until that following week. This is the first day of the month of Adar. I guess now we're into the second. So, yeah. Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you, everyone.
Hello.
Shalom, everyone.
Okay, so that was the Levitical Council call for the first day of Adar, which was a couple of weeks ago, actually, which was after Purim. I wasn't paying attention enough to. I was invited to the actual, hold on a minute. Okay. I wasn't paying attention enough I was invited to join with them up in Lehi, Utah, where Joshua Erickson lives. And I wish I would have gone. I think I get too focused on trying to work and trying to take care of my kids and spend time with my family whenever I can. And I just missed it. So the next holy days that are coming up is Pesach, what the Gentiles call Passover, which is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Festival of Unleavened Bread I think it's a 7-day thing, and then you've got the Feast of First Fruits, and then 50 days later you've got Pentecost or Shavuot. So those are the next feasts that are coming up, and I'm sure they will talk about those things in more detail as we get closer to that time. So I will try to make myself available for putting out the call that was done on Thursday, either on Wednesday or Saturday. And then we'll just go from there. So I will definitely be covering chapters or parts 2 and 3 on Monday and Tuesday of chapter 5 of the Kingdom of God, volume 1, chapter 5. That's the rebellion. So, and I will be doing that at 4:30 p.m. Monday and Tuesday, and then probably, I'm not sure, Wednesday's a little bit of a different day for me, so I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do with that. But anyway, thank you for listening to this this pre-recorded program. I hope that you enjoyed it and learned a lot from it. I think it's important that we know these things. Part of the condemnation the church was placed under in 1832 in Kirtland was not only did they treat the Book of Mormon lightly, but they also treated the former revelations lightly, which includes the Tanakh and the Brit Hadashar, the Old Testament and the New Testament. So I think it's important that we learn about those things and that we try to understand them. I know that Jesus in the Book of Mormon talks a lot about Isaiah and how we should understand that book as well. I mean, all of these things are important. All of the Word of God is important, whether we think it applies to us or not. It does, actually. So anyway, that's the end of the program tonight. I will post it up at facebook.com/LAZURUS1977. And I will also post this program on iTunes. And you can always find it at blogtalkradio.com/fundamentallymormon. Thank you for listening. Take care, everyone. God bless and good night.